Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello, and welcome to Series 3 of The Legacy Tapes, a series of podcasts exploring how to leave something lasting in the ephemeral medium of theatre. I'm Rebecca Atkinson-Lord, and today I'm here in a cupboard called The Chokey at the Armada Theatre with Rupert Gould, who's been the artistic director here since 2013. Before that, he was the AD at Headlong and the Royal and Durngate Theatres, and he's won pretty much all of the directing awards that the UK's got to offer. Hello. Hi, Rupert.
Hi.
So thank you for chatting to me. I think my first question really is, when you kind of first arrive at a theatre like the Armada, or when you first arrived here after Michael, were you aware of a legacy that was being kind of passed on, like a baton of agendas or?
Was I? Yes, I suppose so. You know, not just Michael, but also everyone Jonathan else. Ian and, and Pierre Audi before. When I was at Headlong, we had a lawyer who was our chair initially, who used to use this old legal saw about my grandfather's axe, which was that it's a famous thing that I like.
Yeah, you replace the handle,
replace the head, is it still the axe? About Headlong, which of course had been Oxford Stage Company for many years before that, and how many things did you have to change before it stopped being sort of what it was, in a way. You know, with a touring baseless company, that's probably more
Because it is discussion. Only the people that
exactly and the policy can change. And I suppose, you know, the biggest legacy is protecting the space and the building. You know, Michael had left it in good shape financially, which is not always the case when you take over organizations. The audience were pretty healthy in terms of, like, the sales figures were pretty good. You know, I'm a really strong believer, and I think it's an undervalued thing in theatre that a theatre that has an audience is always a valuable theatre. I think there's no point having a fantastic, exciting policy if no one's coming. So, you know, I was keenly aware of kind of needing to not, you know, throw everyone out. But beyond that, I suppose artistically, if I'm really honest, and this was maybe conceited at some level in a way, but I felt like I left Headlong, or, you know, my Headlong anyway, for a number of reasons. Partly it was a sort of intuitive, that weird merry-go-round that happens when ADs all change, and, like, do I jump or not? But also it had become harder and harder to tour the work, to do with the touring.
Because touring is increasingly hard.
We were losing the idea of getting guarantees against loss was sort of gone, and you're on splits, and everything was tough. And actually, to be honest, even as an artist, the work I was doing to do as a sort of Monday or Tuesday night opening weekly touring was hard. But I felt like the artistic mission, I suppose, our legacy, was still very live, and it was a very sort of emotional and quite painful thing to leave Headlong. And so, yes, I was aware of the Almeida's legacy, but I kind of also was almost more aware of Headlong's ongoing legacy. I said to Jeremy Herrin when he got the job taking over from me that, you know, change the name, trash my legacy. I really believe AD should not try and, it's a bit like football managers, if you try and sort of over-author your successors, it always ends in disaster. And I think there are many evidences in theatre of that, of people trying to do that. So I said to Jeremy, just dance all over my grave, you know, and actually I'd love you to get rid of the pink logo and all the other things.
Kill my darlings.
Yeah, exactly. Partly I was trying to be generous, but probably partly also I wanted to take that with me.
Because that gave you permission to
do it. And actually, to be honest, quite literally, we took a couple of commissions with us that were in infancy or maybe even just in discussion point, but were in relationships to me. And also there was this weird situation where two of the first shows in my first year at the Alameda were Chimerica and American Psycho, which were both headlong shows that we'd spent years developing. Mm. So it was quite a sort of smooth runway in some ways in terms of artistic policy. Or not artistic policy, but like in terms of... And it was an organisation I knew because I'd done Judas Iscariot here, which had been a quite an influential show for headlong. And I think I liked the feel also for the Alameda. So I had sort of, I was sort of wanted to be responsible to Michael's legacy.
But it sounds like you think of legacy as a thing that's attached to a person, not necessarily the company. It's the artistic, the legacy is attached to the artistic voice that's leading a company.
Yeah, I mean, well, I that's what I felt when I started at the Alameda.
Great, go on, what's changed?
Well, I think that... I've only come to realise this quite recently, actually, but I think so much of my experience of policy shaping as an AD is determined by the context that you find yourself in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's no point having a... coming in with a specific policy as an AD and then finding the audience aren't interested in it or, you know, the local community don't support it for whatever reasons. And so my policy for Northampton was defined by a set of factors I found in Northampton when I arrived. Mm-hmm. As was my policy for headlong. It was defined by what mid-scale touring was and the demands of it, and out of that came an artistic policy. Mm-hmm. And that might have been a little less true of the Alameda, because I feel like headlong was a sort of developed brand and maybe the brand values associated with the work I've been making were continuous. But still, you know, there were specific things to do with the Alameda being what I call a Zone 2 theatre. It's sort of, and I talked in my interview here for about Joan Littlewood, Stratford East, or the Bouffe du Nord, or these sort of famed, legendary Zone 2 theatres, and what it meant to be a sort of, or Wuppertal, the Tina Bausch's, you know, dance company, what it meant to be a sort of international class theatre in a specific locality, particularly an urban one. Yeah. I mean, I guess one of the biggest, the things I've realised that I had to fight most in terms of reactive, contextual reshaping of policy at the Alameda were to do with something that's been bubbling along and is, you know, I think was an inheritance of quite differently from Jonathan and Ian's time and Michael's time, which is to do with the deep underlying perception of the Alameda as a sort of uber bourgeois venue. And, you know, I understand why the, you know, it's on a residential street full of, you know, Georgian buildings.
Across
the road from Ottolenghi, exactly. But I think, you know, it's also part of the sort of ongoing post-austerity decade antagonism to the wealth gap in the wider sector, and the fact that artists now are struggling to live in London, and then when they perceive the kind of people as consuming culture being the haves and they're the have-nots, then there's inevitably a bit of a sort of split there. And the truth of Islington is it's actually the most stratified borough, I think, in the country in terms of wealth.
And the history of this place is a revolutionary one that has made that journey into comfort.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, yesterday's revolution becomes today's normalcy. And I think, you know, Jonathan Ian didn't pursue what I'd call necessarily sort of queer theatre policy at all. But I think their aesthetic was part of something that was revolutionary in the early 90s, which was to do with, so some of those elements we now associate with sort of I'm not saying it was camp per se, but it was sort of theatrical, and it was sort of a bit like, I guess, the sort of classic Glasgow Sits aesthetic coming to London. And Pierre Addy, of course, had come from, you know, more avant-garde and the, you know, experimental opera company that had been, opera festival that had been here. I think some of that had drifted away under Michael's time. And I think, you know, to be fair to Michael, he was reacting to a big sort of financial black hole he inherited and had to sort of shore that up. But I think also his interest was in a sort of... He said to me, I sort of, when I was working here in 2008, that he saw the Alameda as a sort of pocket national theatre. So it was sort of a bit of everything. Anyway, I felt like, so the policy, our policy wanted to kind of try and remind people that we were situated not just in a sort of Ottolenghi environment. So that began to challenge sort of the headlong legacy that was ongoing. And then it's evolved since then, my policy, I suppose.
Okay, so that's... I'm just going to go back and talk to you about some of the stuff you just said. Because I think that's really interesting, that idea of the ebb and flow of the avant-garde. Because I think that has to happen, because otherwise it ceases to be the avant-garde. How do you... Because I remember seeing your work when I was a student, and it feeling quite... I always felt like there was a bit of a fuck you. Prospero in the Arctic or whatever, right? And I sort of... I'm just really curious about your relationship to the avant-garde and how you feel yourself located and how that influences what you think about other things. You can also say, I never think about that.
I guess I developed as an artist... either pre the internet or in the early phases of the internet. And one of the things I think was gratifying about that is that I know in my fuck you phase, my more auteur phase.
I mean, to be fair, it was fuck you on the West End with Shakespeare. So yeah, there was a balance there.
Well, I suppose what I felt was that I didn't really have influences, because it wasn't like you could go online and watch. You know, Mila Rao or Ostermeyer or all these, you know, you have so much more access now, and of course there's a more greater flow of international companies and international work. And so it was quite sort of self-derived. And I like to feel that those years when I was doing, I guess, developing a certain style or whatever, were self-generated rather than derivative. Was it avant-garde? I mean... No, I don't think it was at all. I think it felt... I suppose I have always been sceptical about holy theatre.
Can you define your term for me there?
I think... Well, definitely when I graduated, I suppose, sort of Peter Brook still felt like a massive cornerstone for a lot of theatre makers. And I... Although I've really liked some of Brook's work, and I find that book profound, and its bare bones, I think, are, you know, unimpeachable. I think it's really important work. I felt I was watching a lot of people make boring shows, you know, Three Rocks and a sort of rain stick kind of. I
feel like I saw that show recently.
I was like, that's not the world I feel I'm interested in, or even the world that I feel... I mean, I feel so embarrassing heading towards, you know, 46 now, so it's shaming to even kind of invoke this, but it was hard, like, coming out of the early 90s, out of Thatcherism, the sense it was going to change, which sort of, I suppose, had its roots a little bit in alternative comedy in the late 80s, but really, I think, for me, like, I guess when I was leaving school, 89, 90... felt like this big musical explosion, partly led in the north by the Patsy Ender scene, partly led by in London by Soul to Soul and that world. It felt like really new after a period of what felt like a lot of sterility through the mid 80s. And then I can't really overstate the influence of dance music actually on my sensibility. And you know, I wasn't a big rave necessarily, but rave culture, the sort of music and the drugs of that period, I felt like my generation were living a world that had nothing to do with the kind of classical theatre I was seeing. Now, of course, it's a big step to go from like warehouse parties to The Tempest in the Arctic. That wasn't at all. But I think I did feel like the way my generation wanted to express entertainment viscerally was kind of different and had nothing to do with Peter Brook. You know, so I'm rambling now, but I guess so that was a kind of influence, and I, much more that, and then I think postmodernism as an idea, the idea that high and low culture could playfully coexist, you know, that you see in Zizek and Baudrillard, you know, that had been, you know, I was influenced by that, Foucault even, and yeah, I guess that came slightly out of an academic background, but I think also I felt the other hugely influential thing for me was what was going on with the YBAs, the Young British Artists, and that those sensation, that exhibition, sort of that there were these deeply theatrical, formally sort of antagonistic to the idea of the sacrosanctity of the artist. It's no coincidence that we made a show about the Chapman Brothers. They were a big influence on me. I kind of loved all that. I guess also around the same time, in things like Charlie Kaufman films. Now, what underpinned all that, I think, was a belief that I was the kid who played with toys for hours setting up scenes. You know, I was a imaginative, deeply, deeply shy, private child, like a lot of directors.
Yeah, we're all outsiders looking
at it. Yeah. And subsequent to that, and having done a bit of analysis and stuff, I've kind of come to understand that there are roots to that. It isn't just pure, not just a genetic disposition. But I think I was really... So that was true as an absolute. And it had informed, you know, I suppose academically I was always a light being playful and provocative with ideas, much to the infuriation of a lot of my teachers. And then I felt like I was graduating into the mid-90s, and it's funny with what's going on at the moment, but that felt like a fiercely difficult time. I mean, ironically, given that it should be, people think it's more difficult now, but I did feel, so, you know, I'm from all kinds of privilege, you know, and my name's Rupert, you know, much to my horror. You know, I was public school educated, I went to Cambridge, I'm a white man, from a middle-class background, and I am fully aware of the opportunities that privilege has given me and how it, you know, shapes me and how fortunate I am, but also, so I'm not, there's no tiny violin here, but it certainly wasn't welcome at the Royal Court in the mid-90s, and didn't really feel welcome anywhere. And, you know, what's interesting about what's happened in the last year or so in theatre is that actually the arguments have been certainly since all the 20 years I've been in the industry, 25 years, they've just been as strong. It's just things have changed, finally. So I think I was pursuing... my aesthetic was being derived really from an anxiety that my identity should shape my work, because I was worried that no one wanted my identity. And so I wanted to create work that lived purely imaginatively and playfully and that wasn't informed by who I was, but was a sort of purely dream space. And, you know, so... And I remember the Chapmans talking about one of the reasons they worked together was because they're brothers, and so you couldn't work out who had made what part of the work. And
so it was less exposing.
Yeah, they resisted biography.
Yeah.
And I found that deeply appealing. I sort of equally wanted to hide who I was. So I think that shaped the work I was doing much more than like a will to go towards the avant-garde. I mean, I've always been into the avant-garde. You know,
it's not a test. You can be like, I don't care about the avant-garde. Just that's fine. That's not what I'm asking for.
I remember when I was at university, I was in a year of a lot of people who wanted to direct plays. And I was nowhere near the most talented. So there was a guy, Laurie Sansom, who actually my successor at Northampton. He went to Natural History of Scotland. He was doing really interesting work, almost entirely female company. Again, very... And then Chris Good was in my year. He's a really interesting... was making extraordinary work as a student, like really, really breathtakingly beautiful work as a writer and sound designer and performer and director. Both of them, again, with quite a sort of, I guess, what we'd now call a... you know, a queer agenda. Chris's in particular, but Laurie's was, you know, Laurie's, I mean, I just felt like super reactionary compared to those guys. But I will, so one thing I will say is I've always been really drawn to, because I suppose I embody certain kinds of privilege and patriarchy, I'm always really drawn to, not drawn, I am I'm interested in how rocks are thrown in my face artistically.
Yeah, that's really interesting because you are shorthand with I give you all love and respect and admiration, but there is a sense of like you tick all the boxes of the shorthand for privilege, right? And that must be an interesting way to move through the arts world right now.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of feel like all those things that shape me, I guess what? I mean, your consciousness begins maybe when you're 7 or 8, and, you know, the things that people perceive as part of privilege, I guess, in general, slightly fall away around post-university. So that's, what, 12, 14 years of my life, and I feel like I've had as much since then, just being an artist or director or whatever. But of course it shapes one sense of responsibility.
So talk to me a bit about that, because it's interesting, I'm exactly 10 years younger than you.
Right.
And I have quite a lot of the same, like, I'm probably from a less economically privileged background, but I went to a fancy school and I'm very well educated. And and I also feel that it took me a long time to understand that I had the right to speak about anything. And so I see some kinship in that, where this, which is kind of interesting because most of my practice has been in the throwing rocks at Rupert Gould side of the fence, right?
I think bar maybe Richard III, I'm sure there's evidence this isn't the case, but I feel like pretty much for the last 6 or 7 years, all I've done is new work. And, you know, de facto as a director, that is, I do believe, my politics are on the left. My belief in artistic creation is, but my sense of the creative act is, if one can apply that metric, on the right, in that I don't really believe that the arts are, I think a lot of people who are on the left in the arts want their practice also to...
You want them, they want them to be towards, instrumental.
I think they want it to be democratic and inclusive. Right. Mm-hmm. And I love that room as well. But as a producer, as much as a director, I do believe in lead artists.
Yeah.
I believe in directors and writers. And above all, I believe in writers. Sometimes the director might be the writer by another means, but I don't believe in devising. I don't believe in multi-authorship, and not to, I would love to be proved wrong, but
this is awesome. You don't believe in devising? Tell me about that.
I just feel like all the great devising companies that I really love have emerged to reveal that they had a single artistic voice behind them.
What's the difference between devising and writing?
I think somebody is in control of the evening.
Yeah.
And that can be somebody tapping the keyboard, or it can be somebody sitting behind a desk calling themselves the director, or it can be somebody within the devising company who is...
secretly shaping it from within.
Exactly, yeah. And look, and I know that... It's not that... When I say I don't believe in it, I'm really happy to be proved wrong. I just, like, I've been doing it for 25 years, and you know, I've worked with, you know, the Wooster Group, or we've had the Wardrobe Ensemble here recently. You know, I know the Complicité a lot. I look at Dead Center. I'm not saying it's one voice, but I just don't think it's everybody in the room. Everybody in the room contributes, absolutely. But I do think, I believe in leadership.
I believe in the
pyramid, which is really, and people don't want that to be the case because it sounds like there is inherent hierarchies there. But I think there are hierarchies in creativity. They just are. And
yeah, it's funny. I was in an interview for an artistic director job the other day that I didn't get. And they were kind of talking to me about how I ran my room. And I found it really difficult because I sort of, I run a really friendly, collaborative, let's all have a conversation room, but also I'm not going to let anything happen on stage that I don't choose. And so I think pretending that isn't the case is disingenuous. But I think quite a lot of us are encouraged to do it, especially in my, you know, in my generation.
I think the thing, you know, obviously the thing that's happened, this is coming back to the issue about privilege, that is more and more people are, particularly in London now, coming to London because the unfortunate economics of the way that that theatre works, where the most expensive city to live in the country is the one that seems to have all the resource, and the resources are sort of diminishing regionally. So you have that problem of more and more people coming to the city, finding it harder and harder to live there financially, which I totally understand. You know, we had an application for our resident director scheme. We're already looking at 300 applicants for 10 places, and this is just for effectively an assistance scheme. You know, the numbers are so huge in terms of the pressure.
Yeah.
And it's not just directors, it's on designers, whatever. And you now have social media. So the disenfranchised voices of all those held without are loud and animated.
Mm-hmm.
And so inevitably those voices who are shut out will want to challenge the structures that are seeming to shut them out. And good, you know, they should do. That's revolutionary movements. That's how that happens. That doesn't mean that some of the selective processes that are leading artists onto the stage are wrong, and the sieves that those ideas and artists pass through may be the right sieves. You know, I applied for loads of artistic director jobs before I got my one at Northampton. Was I ready before? I would suspect I probably was. Do I understand why they didn't give them to me? Now I do, absolutely. So, you know, life is long and you learn through your knockbacks.
Tell me about it. I'm currently keeping a spreadsheet of jobs I have not got and the feedback on why. And one day when I spot a pattern, I'll be like, well, that's the answer. But
listen,
I haven't yet.
I think rejection is a...
it's really important.
Hugely important. Yeah. You know, I was...
Because also, it's like dating. I'm polyamorous, so I spend a lot of time dating, so all of my references are about that. If that person doesn't want you, I do not, you know, I'm not going to bed with someone that doesn't want to be there with me. I'm not committing my creative identity to that, you know?
Yeah.
No, I mean, look,
I think there's a reason that our source myths and ur narratives are about struggle. They're not about utopia and happiness and ambrosia and free love. They're about trial and adversity, and you know, we are shaped through through all those things. And I mean, people, that's the thing I feel angriest about, some of the accusations that people make against other people, not necessarily me, but no, you have no idea what people have been through personally. You have no idea what the state of their mental health is, what their familial background might be, what their education background was, you know, what their experience in the early part of their career may be. People just make huge assumptions, and you know, in reality, there's probably nobody who's working and really speaking to an audience and bringing audiences in, you know, whatever you may think of their work, who hasn't had to struggle to get there.
Yeah, I think that I want to go back to something else in a minute, but I think that sense of just right now, that I guess the difference between practitioners coming up now who are sort of 10 years behind me, so 20 years behind you, is that sense of there's always, because of Twitter and you know, the internet, there is always someone throwing rocks at you. It isn't just Rupert Gould who gets rocks thrown at him. You know, if someone sees your little show at CPT and thinks it was obnoxious, you're going to hear about it. And I guess you have to grow a much thicker skin if you're dealing with that all the time.
Yeah. I mean, I do think there's this thing about the pie. Like, you know, I feel this sort of, with some hard left politics at the moment, that there's so much fixation on how the pie is split. And there are some people...
I'm getting more centrist with my old age, but there's quite a lot of splitting of the pie obsession on the hard right as well.
Everyone's
obsessed with splitting the pie.
Yeah, I suppose what I'm interested in is people, and this is different in capitalist economics, but it, culturally, you make the pie bigger. So those people who, you know, actually, like if you build a new theatre, you know, I don't care about the policy. The fact you've made a new theatre and a new space is a great achievement, a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you find an audience,
mm-hmm.
you know, and your work grows, that's a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to judge Tina or whatever, the musical, like, whatever. I haven't seen it. It's probably brilliant.
Yeah.
But, you know, I feel like, you know, I remember when, you know, the whole thing about Peter Hall not being celebrated at the Olivier's. I was like, you know, was Peter Hall an influence on me as a director? Not at all. Was he an influence on me as an artistic director? Not really. He was a different generation, although I like his books. I think they're really interesting. But we are in his debt about the Arts Council and the RC and the National and the idea of state funding of the arts. You know, without Peter Hall, we would have less work. We just would. And so, yes, the how the pie is split is really, really important. But I also feel the most important thing is to communicate.
And there'd be complexity in that. Like, I think your allegory of splitting the pie requires clean knife lines. And I think that's often where that silofication of things is where we get really fucked up.
Yeah.
So we've talked quite a lot about stuff that you have carried with you that has impacted you.
Mm-hmm.
There are some questions that I'm going to ask at the end that I ask everyone, but like, I'm really curious about what you are seeking to pass on of that. Like,
at the Almeida or in general?
whatever you choose. Because there's probably not as much difference as people think between what you want to pass on and what you want your Almeida to pass on, right? I mean, I'm assuming you don't want to bankrupt the organisation and hopefully not burn it down. But barring that, like, in terms of your impact on the culture, what do you want it
to be? I suppose, you know, I am interested in... provocative, big political plays that are theatrically exciting. I mean, that has always been, you know, I guess what I'm interested in. And each of those adjectives one could anatomise in interesting ways. But practically what that would mean, I suppose, is a belief that theatre can speak to the now, not just in a narrow, this is my story about my world, but about our story.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, my story can be our story. I totally understand that. And, you know, I'd say, you know, a show like, I don't know, The Writer that we did here was, you know, very linked to Ella as an artist, but I felt was a very inclusive story for what where the conversation was at. So, you know, I feel it's our responsibility that we should always be shaping... Yeah, we live in such a crazy world at the moment. It's changing so fast. It's theatre's job to bring people together in a live space, in a room, and try and make sense of it, and also to try and challenge the increasingly massive fault lines between different parties and different sectors. And I hope that it's a body of work that promotes that as an idea for theatre and that also is a legacy of... maybe a generation, it doesn't have to be a generation, or a group of artists who, you know, we've brought to attention, who are visionary in that field. You know, I sometimes I think of it as a, you know, I guess we are more narrow and deep. We only have six shows a year. We've got up to six from five. We're not the National. So we try and invest as deeply and as fully as possibly in each show.
Yeah.
You know, they get a lot of artistic support from the team here. And I guess maybe underlying that is partly as a producer, I don't feel I'm very, at this stage anyway, able to produce more than that.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I wouldn't be giving of my best.
Yeah.
But also, you know, I don't think I don't think it's purely structural that every 5 or 10 years, probably only, you're lucky if you get 10 major theatre makers out of a period, if you include writers and directors. So I think it is rare. I think real talent is rare, and it's our responsibility to look everywhere for it and in a non-discriminatory way. But I sort of probably believe that if you see the embers of real talent, that is extraordinarily rare, and it is my job as an artist director to fan them as much as possible to turn that into a sort of flame. So it probably isn't much more complicated than a bunch of people you go, wow, they're great, they started at the Almeida, or they did their best work at the Almeida. Yeah. Maybe that they, you know, raised their game as a particularly as a writer or director, but maybe an actor as well, or a designer. You know, the working here had opened them up a bit creatively. Mm. I think I'd be happy with that. I don't have aspirations massively beyond that. I mean, do I want to? Yes, of course, I want to change the audience here a bit. You know, although I think we have done that a lot. And I suppose I probably also further down the line, I think it is one of us. It's not really probably my job, but needs to get on the front foot about the case for funding again, because I feel like for some reason we're all killing each other about what we're doing rather than the government who are, you know, quietly just emptying the pot.
And while all that happens, as a society, we lose the ability to talk about art and culture in any way.
Yeah, and we're literally, the argument that the arts should be subsidised is having to be rebooted now, having spent 50 years being fought.
Yeah.
That's a disaster.
Yeah.
So I feel like we have to all do that, but I think also I have to be mindful about trying to recognise that it is a mixed economy now, and we have 320 seats. I think ticket prices are invidious in London, and we have a real desire to try and open that up much more with our under 25 schemes, but also just try and hold ticket prices down. I think wages are appalling, particularly for actors, but also for creatives, freelancers. You know, at some point, those economics get really complicated. You can't have a finite number of seats, hold your prices down, and pay people properly, and balance the books, unless you find money elsewhere. And I think, so that's the other big project.
What if we, like, did less?
Less work?
Less, like, what if we did less bad theatre?
But it's quite a lot. No one sets theater. Out to do bad theatre.
No, I know, but there are some repeat offenders out there.
Well,
I'm just curious, in this world where we can't get more money...
I think we should be careful about it, because like the prejudices you make about like what is bad theatre is that the same as low-risk theatre? Because if, like, sometimes you take a risk and someone will be bad, and the risks are necessary to take on...
Yeah, no, I also hate low-risk theatre. So.
I mean, yeah, we've looked at doing, say, four shows a year rather than six, or smaller cast sizes, that would make a big change.
Mm.
But, like, why do less work? I mean, like, that feels, like, really counterintuitive to me. Mm-hmm. Again, it's the pie slicing.
Yeah.
Like, I'm saying grow the pie, don't redistribute it.
Okay.
And so find more money. And it's why I get really angry. And we don't actually make a huge amount of money from our commercial exploitations. We're trying to do better on the deals, but realistically, actually, people might look at us and go, oh, but they're doing it. We don't. But we do make... But it is a revenue stream now.
But no one anywhere has any money, anywhere. To pay for that exploitation, you know.
But, you know, I think there are, you know, we look at, you know, there's a sloshing money around in TV at the moment. There's so much money in TV with subscription channels. We are directly feeding that with, particularly with the writers, but also other talent. You know, there are ways of leveraging that. I don't quite know what they are yet, but we're looking into them. You know, there's a burgeoning...
I mean, Audible are producing.
Audible, there's the whole games industry. There's a lot of money in storytelling. There's a hell of a lot of money. People are staying at home, sitting on their nice sofas and watching their increasingly large TVs or playing games. And there's a lot. And we are the architects and the vanguard of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying, I sound terribly right wing, like the government should be paying for it. But if they don't, what are you going to do? Just like redistribute the pie endlessly as the pie shrinks and shrinks and shrinks and shrinks and shrinks until we're arguing over pennies.
Or maybe as an art form, we need to evolve to a place where we can play better. With gaming and with recording.
Yeah, or we embrace, and we haven't done this at the Almeida because I feel like it's not our duty, it's not our remit, or not our remit, I guess, or not our priority at the moment, but, you know, I see people like sniping about the National doing Curious and Warhorse or whatever, and you go, no, good on them, Matilda and the RSC. It's like, if you, like, why shouldn't, you know, arts organisations try and generate more income, to try and do more work for all those disenfranchised artists and audiences, excluded audiences. I mean, it's really important that we are...
And also, if you come from where I come from, which is not a culturally engaged background, like, my mum might have taken me to see Matilda.
Yeah.
She wouldn't take me to see anything at the Royal Court or the National or here. You know, like,
we have a young board here who are sort of advising us on all sorts of things. They're all under 25 from really, you know, very different backgrounds. I'm amazed how uninterested they are in avant-garde theatre. They just want cheaper tickets for good theatre. They want to see Andrew Scott in Hamlet more than they want to see Dance Nation. Mm. Now, that doesn't mean we don't do Dance Nation, but I was really struck by, actually, it's not just avant-garde work for emerging audiences. Mm. Actually, emerging audiences want to see the work that actually traditional audiences want to see. They just can't afford it. And, you know, so there's much more nuance, I think, than some of the sort of...
Yeah, maybe the whole idea of avant-garde and not is a false dichotomy that we should stop buying into. Maybe it's just different ways to tell stories and key into different emotional and intellectual experiences.
Yeah, and also I think we should sort of... I don't know, just be less prejudicial about... Speaking to a couple who come to the theatre quite regularly, they, you know... I guess they're in their 50s... They probably have made some money. They might superficially look exactly like the kind of traditional Almeida audience that a lot of people would be really, you know, hostile to. They're both working class kids from Glasgow who went to art school. One's in graphic design, the other's an illustrator. They've done well.
Mm.
Like, they want to see the really avant-garde work. They want to see Sacha Ware stuff. They don't want to see King Charles III, for example.
I love that in your world, Sasha Ware is avant-garde.
Yeah, okay.
I love that.
That's avant-garde is where we
love
are.
Love her work. Yeah. Brilliant.
Or Dickie Bow, or whatever. They want to see, you know... But, of course, you go in them and see them with a glass of white wine and go, oh, bloody hell. And, you know, I feel like there's so much, like, judgment all the time.
Maybe
about,
we should
like,
all just stop being dicks to each other.
Yeah, yeah, and just go, like... You know, for me, the rich donor who falls asleep watching a show... is undeserving of a ticket. But that is also true of the 17-year-old who's brought by their school group, who also chats or spends their whole time on the phone. It's like, we want people who want to listen to the story. The work has to be good enough to communicate them. I get that. But let's not... There is no bad celebration. If people feel great about being in a theatre, about the work, that is a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all right.
Yeah.
Too much negativity.
Okay, I have two last questions for you. One, why do you do this?
Being an AD or directing?
Ooh, nice dichotomy there. Let's do directing.
Well, many reasons. I suppose, like, at root, the sad truth is I'm a bit of a groupie for actors. I just, like... You know, I just think they're really entertaining, and it's the only way I can be around them is to direct. I feel like I can stage manage. And I really enjoy the sort of, I don't know, it's a strange secret language you have with a director and actor about their performance and developing that. So so that's a sort of social thing. But I also... you know, just in a childish, you know, kid with toys thing, I just love seeing a show on stage. I love the wonder of that. It still is really weird. We had our first preview of a show last night, and I still was like, it looks amazing. Look what we've done in this room. It wasn't even my show. So that, and I feel like, despite all the headaches around theatre, there is less bullshit about how you get to that point. Mm-hmm. Than there is in TV and film. And being an AD, I think, because... I do like a family. I like relationships beyond the 5 or 6 weeks of rehearsal period. But also, I have a sort of... whatever, like a disposition to strategy, I suppose, artistic strategy, and I'd love to be a great, great, great director. I think occasionally I've done great, great shows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know I'm not Evo. You know, it's funny when Evo arrived, and you're like, oh, right, that's like so much better than like me. What's also great is it's so much better than all of us. Bow down. It's not always great. That's
yeah,
human.
And also it's the point of view. Like, it depends where you're looking at it from.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. But technically, it's still pretty special. So I feel like I'm in the whatever percentile as a director, but I feel actually weirdly as an artistic director, I think, and it slightly saddens me to say this in some ways, I think I might, that might be what I'm best at, in terms of producing other people, programming. Mm-hmm. And I know people will probably look at this theatre and go, that's rich, and they might hate our work. But fine. Some people don't.
Do you feel under siege a bit here? I'm psychoanalyzing you now.
Oh, yeah, we have. And people write really, really horrible things about us, and that's like, anyway, I mean.
Oh, like, I mean, what was it? Waving your pussies around. Good old Quentin.
Oh, who cares about Quentin? I don't care about Quentin. No, no, I mean, like, you have to respect people to. No, I like, you know, you see people write stuff like, I mean, just appalling things. Do I feel under siege? No, look, I know probably we are against the norm a bit now, and the root of that probably is to do with my identity. But I also think that people are still really, a lot of people are still really excited about the programme at the Almeida, and I think there, I think there is this weird. When we did the writer, we had this interesting. Thing where the really right-wing press, so the Mail and Sunday Times, and the really left-wing press, so like, I guess, by which I mean the Time Out stage, some of the bloggers, said the same thing, and it had been kind of rumbling, and basically the left-wing press sort of liked the play and the right-wing didn't. Whatever, that's true of most probably the Almeida. But what they both said is how much they couldn't stand the Almeida audience. And I was really, like, horrified. And, of course, for the right-wing press, it's because they look like remaining commentariat. And for the left-wing press, it's because they look like hand-wringing liberals with no responsibility. Yeah. Neither of which are true, actually, statistically. Mm-hmm. But that angered me. I was like, and that's to do with, I think that's to do with the specific thing about, I think that's to do with Islington. It's like what Islington is and the how people, it's sort of like a buzzword for Granita and Otto Lengi. And I just think, like, grow up to those people, like, come to our audience, actually, it's bullshit.
If you are in this audience, like,
I sit at the Royal Court, that's in Sloane Square, I sit at the Littleton. It's like, don't tell me our audience is like that, those audiences, and I'm respectful of those audiences. Like, and don't tell me Islington is actually like more privileged than Chelsea or Notting Hill with the gay, you know, I've worked there as well. It's like, it's just, but there's something about Islington that gets under people's nose. I suppose it's because there's something unapologetically gin and tonic about the home counties audience that comes to the West End and some of the National and some of the Court, whereas ours does kind of sometimes, like, honestly, down with the kids or something. But
they're much more metropolitan.
Yeah. Do I try and siege? Actually, much less than we did. I think I feel like we've opened up the organisation much, much more. We've had loads of sort of interesting, porous hemorrhaging in the organisation either way in the last couple of years, and I think that's led to really interesting discussions, and I feel like it's an organisation I'm really, really proud of. I really wish this building we're in now, 108 off Up Street, I just wish that was part of the main theatre complex, because if people could see all the artists and kids and young people who are coming a part of our organisation, what our green room looks like on a day-to-day basis, they could see the sort of chaotic, super, to be honest, rich, diverse, eccentric, but we're down the road and it's all behind a secret door, so you don't see that. When I go to theatres like, I don't know, the Young Vic or the Nash, and you see all that in the foyer and you think, we do that as well, but we do our own version of that, but it's invisible. And so I'd love that to be more declared. And
actually, a bit more sung.
I think the stuff that our participation team connecting to our main programme do is really, really, like, exemplary, cutting edge in a way. And I wish people could see that. But it's our job to make that more visible. And I hope they do.
Okay, last question, because I'm aware I have a minute or something left with you. when you go from this place,
yeah,
and I encourage you to think of that as this astral plane rather than this small cupboard.
Right.
when you go, you know, when you leave, what would you like? What do you want people to say about you? What would you like to have left changed? What would you like to leave behind? You know, what are the bullet points in your eulogy?
I feel deeply conflicted about that because...
tell me why.
You know, because it is an ephemeral medium, and I think that, that part of its philosophical, mystical power is that it does vanish.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we are written on the sand. So I try and endeavour not to care about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but you also just said that you wanted to be a great, great, great director.
Yeah, like, but I recognise my limitations.
Sorry, I was just... Yeah. I'm with you on the ephemerality, but I'm also calling bullshit, because also a lot of your... So much of how you seem to move through the world is powered by a self-belief.
Oh, really? Why did you say that? In the work, or...?
Yeah.
I don't
know. Yeah.
Self-belief. I don't know. What, as in, like, I think it's good, or...
Or certainly, like, you have a right to speak. You have a right...
God, I feel exactly the opposite at the moment. I talked about this the other day. I have a right to make work, but I don't have a right to speak at all.
Oh, God, another hour, please. What is the difference between making work and having a right... What, like, are you not speaking when you're making work?
You are, but that's art. You know, art is a way of speaking, but it is not didacticism. You know, one of the things we try and do here, actually, I even thought about, like, whether to do this meeting is, like, I don't really believe in articulating policy and sort of, you know, I really admire what Sean did with Secret Theatre and everything, but, or Vicky with Oaken Court, but, like, I feel like we tried to make the work speak for itself and people can infer the policy out of that, and I still feel that, really. So I feel like the work is the speech, and by nature it has to be ambiguous, so it can't be, you know, it is offered up into the world. It's not didactic. It's not... I don't believe in didacticism in art or...
Yeah, but Rupert Gould, come on. Come the fuck on. Our society is woven from the stories we tell about it and ourselves. And you have said probably 15 times today, you've talked about storytelling, and that's what you do. So, sorry, I've decided I'm going to be a dick to you, apparently. That's what I've decided today.
You're welcome. So what I think is that cultures live in states of anxiety. And theatre's job, or art's job, is to interrogate that anxiety and possibly bring healing to it.
Mm-hmm.
And the job of narrative art, and I sort of, I guess, most theatre is narrative and most of my theatre is narrative, is to, through narrative, to hold the most complex form and the most profound form of the argument that sits across each anxiety. I don't think it is there to declare either way.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever, and I don't, you know, it's amazing how little, when working dramaturgically with writers or in production, one is thinking of, like, oh, we need to tell them this. Your aim, I always think as a director, is to hold the argument in the most compelling tension as late and long as possible.
Mm-hmm.
That was always our sort of headlong ethos. So that's what I mean. I think art is ambiguous. Ambiguity sits in recognising the complexity of anxiety, the complexity of the deep disturbance it causes, and through argument, ideally embodied in character, but it doesn't have to be visually, those ideas are held in tension, and that is what the art does. That is not the same as saying, I think it's wrong that refugees aren't allowed through Calais or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That's a different thing, which is not to say I didn't think that show was brilliant, by the way, but actually I found that show brilliant not only because it was saying that, because it was also making me think about space and communality and materialism in different ways. So in that sense, I don't believe in preaching, and I don't feel confident to preach. I feel confident about trying to drill in, confident in my integrity of trying to drill into those anxieties and ask those questions. And why do I feel confident in that? I guess because I feel like that's what 25 years of doing it does is you kind of get better at recognising what the deep structures are of the argument. So legacy.
So your eulogy, if we said that you held space for complexity.
I think I... I suppose I... Like, what are the qualities I most admire in other people? This is a tangential but linked thing. And I think, unfortunately, one of them is wit. I just find, like, I'm always drawn to people who make me laugh in a facile way. But I feel like if I could just sit on that for a bit, then I think I have a lot of interest in this idea of humility, I guess, and like what it means to have humility as an artist. And how you balance the very thing I started with about the pyramid and sort of top-down leadership and the need to fill the empty page, the empty stage, lead the room, with genuine humility about what you don't know and where your prejudices might be and where your certainty might be built on unsteady foundations. And... I think I'm quite low status as an AD in the organisation and quite low status in the rehearsal room. I think most people who would work with me would go... And sometimes I get more attacked for not being confrontational enough. And I tend to be... Or to listening to too many people, I get a lot of that. Like, a sort of over-inclusive, as though, like, it's a form of stasis. I hope, I suppose, that people would... I mean, how can you, this is utterly contradictory to say that the thing I hope everyone remembers before is my humility, but I would like to feel that the organisation we ran was humble in the face of what he didn't know.
Nice. David Jobs said he hoped he'd be remembered for just getting out of the way.
At the end?
Yeah. That was, which I thought...
I'm not ready to go yet, so...
No. It's just an interesting thing, right, about, like... that humility, that's just a thread that I'm noticing as I talk to these, as I do these things.
Yeah, it's a very leaving is really hard. I mean, I'm an AD and I've done it twice now. It's incredibly emotional. It like deeply traumatizing. Yeah.
When I left, I mean, entirely different level to you, but when I left Oval House, I think I'd kind of, I sort of hated the place by the time, because it had been quite, just I'd worked so hard and it hadn't pushed, I hadn't managed to push it far enough up the hill.
Yeah.
And I sobbed walking out the door, while absolutely being sure it was the right thing to do. So I get the emotionalness of that leaving this thing that you've loved for so long.
But I don't know what it is that you... Of course, what you leave is not the work you're going to do in the building or the organisation that exists, you know, uninterested in you as you move on. What you leave is the memories, because the memories somehow stay live while you're still there. You know, I feel like I go up to the theatre and, you know, I'd be in the tech for King Charles III and Tim would still be alive and it's still there while you're... It's very like parenting, actually. I find it weirdly about parenting is sort of, you look at your child and go, can I see the 3-year-old you and the 13-year-old you? Like the margins of day-by-day change are so infinitesimal that I lose it. But I know, but suddenly you'll be gone and the 3-year-old will be very vivid to me.
Yeah.
And so I feel like the soup of all the stuff we've made at the Almeida still is in the room. And, like a balloon that's going to be punctured or something. I feel... sick about the idea of leaving, which is not to say that I hold on.
That's
by
okay.
My
it's not a requirement that you're about to quit.
I mean, it obviously it's interesting. There's so many new kinds of artistic leaders coming into the industry now, and you know, I wonder whether the work I've done or even if there is an identity of the work, that it will be as irrelevant as, you know, Rattigan was to John Osborne. Do you know what I mean? I feel like I'm fascinated by, for example, that moment, you know, what must have happened when these playwrights who made a living and been their culture suddenly were redundant.
It's not, is it? Like, it's never irrelevant because it's what had to go before.
Yeah. But then, you know, I know when I was doing more subconsciously authored work, like when you were saying when I was doing things like The Tempest, I'd have a lot of people come up to me and go, oh my God, your six characters made such an influence on me, or, you know, oh, I love what you did in Macbeth. Yeah. Which I don't get now about the new plays that I've been working on. But I, you know, you have to pass that on. You can't always be, you know, Lepage.
And also you have to let it sit. Like, there are things that influenced me. Like, actually, bless me. When I saw those shows, all three of those shows, I didn't know that 15 years later I would remember them and think about them. And so that impact you kind of, you have to let sit.
Yeah. I mean, that is the great thing about theatre, isn't it? It's like, we all go to loads of it.
And meaning like you say, is never fixed. Meaning evolves across the audience's lifetime as they think about that piece of art.
Yeah, but and then there's memorable ones, particularly, and you tend to see them when you're young, but they're not always. You know, if I think of The Damned when I saw this a couple of years ago, or Mnemonic, the first time I saw Mnemonic publicity show, you know, I'd be horrified at seeing Mnemonic again in case it wasn't, you know, as nearly as good as I remember it, which was life-defilingly good.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was. But, you know, so I suppose you try and build a place in your heart for those shows yourself.
Mm.
And again, a bit like parenting, it's weird how you sort of love and cherish and seek to polish in your mind the ones that were most hostilely received. I'm only 46, you know, still got some time left.
Yeah. All right. Is there anything that you feel like you should add or you want to say? Or
about legacy?
Anything you want. I mean, it's not really like we've been that focused.
God, no, not really. I don't think, I mean, I feel like we've talked quite a lot about politics and that was like kind of...
Oh, no, you've got slightly. I'm usually much worse than this about politics.
No, not really. I mean, like I say, the work speaks for itself.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Rupert.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.